And welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. My name is James Serene. This is episode 86, and we are focusing on the US plan for Israel and the Palestinians. This week, Benny Gantz, the leader of the opposition Blue and White Party, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu travel to Washington to be briefed about the details of this long-awaited US plan. This could potentially be a week that changes a great many things in the Middle East and could disrupt a lot of the previous assumptions about what a US plan could or should look like. I'm joined by Richard Pater, our director in Israel, and our research director, Neri Zilber. Thank you very much for joining me, gentlemen.
Nice to have you back in Israel, James.
Thank you.
Thanks, James.
So if we could just start off by trying to analyse what it is we've already heard. So we know that there were briefings in Israel to some of the Israeli politicians about what's expected to be in this plan. I should say that we don't know that the plan is actually going to be published. We don't know if it's just going to be the case that President Trump will set out some broad sort of principles and give away some of what he would like this final plan to be. It's unlikely we'll see a full published document. But what we did hear about in the Israeli media were a number of things. We heard about a lot of areas in the West Bank staying under Israeli control, and we heard about potential a lot of Israeli settlements staying under Israeli control. We heard about there being a Palestinian state, but in the future, and that would be subject to a number of restrictions, such as Hamas disarming. The Palestinians would have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. I'd ask a big question at the beginning. What do we think about what they're talking about so far? I mean, is this an attempt to solve the conflict through negotiations, or is this just an attempt to try and just completely reshape the whole framework of the way people consider an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians?
I would suggest that it's probably the latter. I don't think it's an attempt, or as the Trump administration says, a vision for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think it's a means for the Trump administration and certain key figures in the administration to put forward what they believe, and what many, I would say, on the Israeli right believe, is the solution that should be imposed from the Israeli side, at least, to mitigate the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And we see it, as you mentioned, in a slew of various issues that whose details have been leaked somewhat. No settlements arguably will be taken down. Palestinians will not get real access to East Jerusalem, maybe some outlying neighborhoods beyond the wall of Jerusalem. The refugee issue has been taken off the table. The issue of Palestinian statehood, can will be kicked down the road, I think, for a number of years. So all that taken together, you can't help but not see it as a means to impose a certain vision on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, number one. And then number two, obviously, the timing of the release, 5 weeks before a critical Israeli election, can't help but also suggest that there is a political motivation behind releasing the plan.
But if we step back from the politics and why we think it's actually happening, I think what the Trump administration, it strikes me, seem to be doing, and they've been doing this, since at least 2017, is they've taken every assumption about how you try and solve a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and that has evolved over the last sort of nearly 30 years since Oslo, and they've taken almost every one of those and said, well, we don't believe that those assumptions are correct, and we are going to sort of slowly remove those. And so, recognizing Israeli control over the West Jerusalem, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, moving the U.S. embassy there, cutting the funding to UNRWA, most recently saying that settlements are not illegal per se in international law. Isn't this just the Trump administration just saying, well, we don't believe that, there has to be this big compromise on both sides. We just think that, on a lot of the issues, Israel's right. And we're just going to set out a framework that we think is the right direction to go and to hell with it. Isn't that what they're really saying?
Well, I mean, very much so. I mean, what's incredible, I think, is that away from the conventional wisdom of kind of State Department and American diplomacy, which is kind of grounded in the ideas of establishing peace between two competing entities looking for self-determination, if you look at the individuals behind Trump, and this is kind of the anomaly and what's so incredible that the Israeli right really cannot believe their luck, that you have the personalities involved of David Freeman, who just by default of being the lawyer of Trump has now been promoted to this position of ambassador, and obviously his son-in-law Jared Kushner, and before him Jason Greenblatt, now being replaced by his deputy Berkovich. All these people are religious right-wing Jews who are governing American foreign policy in an unprecedented stage that is leading to a stance now which is fully supported by the Israeli right, and so at least superficially the Israeli right wing have never had it so good. Obviously, we don't know how long if Trump is going to be re-elected and whether the pendulum will swing back the other way. But right now, Trump, who is kind of just going with the advice of people that he trusts, who happen to be incredibly pro-Israel with a right-wing stance, are running with this. And this is the result of it, that if we finally see this plan put out, it is the fruit of their labors, of what they put into it for the last 2 years.
But what, I mean, let's ask the question, what is it actually going to achieve? So if they actually set out some broad principles this week or even publish a plan, what actually happens? Because you do need, if you want to solve a conflict, you do need both sides of the conflict to buy into that manner of solving the conflict, and then actually you're some way to solving it. So they're not going to have achieved that objective if as is likely, the Palestinians, you know, carry on their boycott of the US and just reject everything, and they're joined in that rejection by some Arab states that actually have quite good relations with Israel. So what's actually going to be achieved, we think, by the end of this week, Neri?
Well, it's much easier to win a negotiation when there's only one side taking part, which is a big part of the problem, that the Palestinians, by their own decision and also by the actions of the U.S. administration, are not at the table currently, and don't seem to be returning to the table anytime soon. What will actually happen after the plan is released? I expect not too much. The U.S. can put out their parameters. They can put out their plan. That's all well and good. The Israelis can even embrace it. But the Palestinians, unlikely that many of the Arab states, if any, will also embrace it. The Europeans will be flat out against it, as well as most of the rest of the world. So all that taken together, it just means what will actually happen on the ground is what the Israeli government may or may not choose to happen on the ground. And that'll have, I think, a snowball effect moving forward.
Well, that's a big question to bring Richard in on that. I mean, you know, we have this strange situation where there is a caretaker Israeli government, we're our third election, and if something is set out in a lot of detail this week and that gets traction, then surely there's a limit to what the caretaker government can do just a few weeks out from an election.
For sure. I mean, if I can answer your last question, because I really don't think this is going to achieve anything. I don't think even the objective is necessarily there to achieve peace. I think this has short-term goals for both the US and the Israeli government in a very short term, as in literally this week, the next 2 weeks, of changing the conversation. It's useful for Trump in the context of impeachment to be seen as running with an international initiative, even if it gets completely rejected by one side and the other partners, so to speak, the stakeholders in Europe and the rest of the Arab world are completely dismissive. He changes the conversation and shows that he's bringing an initiative. Right. And similarly on the Israeli side, one can't help but be incredibly cynical that this is timed for the same day, the indictment hearings of the Prime Minister and the vote of the Knesset and the authorization of a House committee to be formed to discuss the immunity of the Prime Minister. So this has a clear short-term advantage, and even slightly to medium-term. As you mentioned, we're in the run-up to an election with 5 weeks to go. Again, this changes the conversation away from the alleged criminal doings of the Prime Minister, and changes it again to, as Prime Minister Netanyahu liked to run the last campaign, to show that how close he is in close coordination with President Trump and playing on another league, as he would say, on a world level, operating with world leaders. That, in the context of the success diplomatically the Prime Minister was able to reap last week with all the international leaders coming in, that's how he wants to frame the current election.
But the irony in that is that, you know, there is this big issue in Israel about what it does around its control of the West Bank. Like, you know, at some point it has to make a big public policy decision about, you know, where it's actually going, where it's heading, and to actually think about what the consequences of that are for Israeli society. So ironically, yes, it does change the conversation from Benjamin Netanyahu and his indictments for corruption, but it also, does it not force the Israeli media and senior Israeli politicians like Benny Gantz to actually come out and say something substantive about what they would do about their relations with the Palestinian Authority? Or does it just end up with a very shallow argument about whether this is a good plan or not? I mean, what any thoughts on that, Larry?
I think it does push it, as Richard said, into the public conversation. I think it pushes it into public conversation in exactly the wrong way.
Right.
In the lead up to an election, a very contentious now third election, in the midst of a prime minister's indictment and corruption battle. But worse than that, it feeds into the worst impulses of, I would say, not only the Israeli right, but the Israeli public at large, that they can have their cake and eat it too, that no real hard decisions will have to come down, as you said, about the future of the West Bank, which by implication means the future of Israel as both a Jewish and democratic state. And they're almost indulged by this kind of quirk of a U.S. administration headed by Donald Trump and now staffed, as Richard said, by people very close to the settler movement here in Israel. So yes, it pushes it into the public debate, but I think not constructively so.
So let's look at what may happen in terms of, you know, the detail of what we end up talking about in terms of the U.S. plan. What are the consequences of a plan that comes out and says Israel doesn't need to leave any settlement?
Give up anything.
Every settlement in the West Bank is fine and, you know, really just carry on as you are. I mean, what kind of consequence is that? Is it Israeli society? Do you have a situation there when you go into an election where, you know, all the parties and Likud and to the right of Likud and the whole settlement movement feels like they've won? Or have they just got a vote of confidence from a U.S. administration? Actually, they still haven't won the argument and they certainly haven't come up with a tangible, concrete future solution.
So it'll be interesting to see what the details are and what's put out. Over the last day, there were some reports indicating that some parts of the West Bank, not settlements, but just land, mm-hmm. may have to be given up, and that certain concessions might have to be made on that point. Also, you know, perhaps outlying neighborhoods of Jerusalem. But really, in terms of the settler movement, I would imagine that most of them would be pro this plan, but there might be outlying parts of the settler movement that might have an issue with, you know, even the idea of a future Palestinian state. Although, by Israeli definitions and also apparently by American definitions, this isn't really going to be a state. It's going to be maybe the status quo that we have now with an autonomous entity, maybe plus some bells and whistles. So, yes, there might be an internal debate among the settler movement, but going back to your previous question, what will actually happen on the ground, I don't think the settlers or even the Israeli government will have to make any hard decisions in the coming months, if not years, about these issues.
What about Benny Gantz? So he was in a strange position at the end of last week where this was all coming to a head and people talked about the fact that he was being ambushed, that he faced the decision of either going to Washington and having to really support this deal and then looking like, you know, he was Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing sidekick, or alternatively, any critique he makes of the plan, he ends up looking like he's not only going against a sitting administration, which is a big deal, but also, you know, it creates an open goal for the right to accuse him of being a leftist. I mean, how does he navigate his way through this, you think, Richard?
Well, I think, first of all, you're right. When the invitation first came out, it looked like a classic trap, that he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't. And the optics of him going along, standing on the side as Trump embraced Netanyahu, hanging on to his coattails, would have been a terrible look for him. And there were plenty of trapdoors that he could have fallen into. In credit to him, he has kind of pivoted himself quite smartly. First of all, by insisting that if the invitation is really for him from Washington, then it comes from the Americans directly, and therefore he was able to articulate and kind of find space for himself to meet privately with Trump. It now appears, just as we're starting to record this, that Bibi has again trumped him, so to speak, and will go in and meet him ahead of the meeting first before he meets with Gantz. But in any case, it looks like Gantz is going to try and create some separate space to at least have his own private meeting with Trump. But more importantly, is kind of the policy messages that come out for it, because I think he can find the messaging that says, yes, we embrace and support and respect the Americans, what they've come out with, whilst at the same time repeating his own messages that the only way to do a true deal is by direct negotiations, bilateral negotiations with the Palestinians, with buy-in from the fuller extent of the international community, not just the Americans, but the Europeans and the Arab world as well. And if he sticks with that and kind of sounds reasonable and stately, again, we're not sure if anything is going to come of this plan, so we shouldn't get too ahead of ourselves, but he can at least articulate a position that sounds appropriately patriotic for an Israeli public, but also kind of sensible and real worldly enough to stand the test of let's say the Europeans, that are going to be naturally more skeptical.
I would add one more point that has been somewhat overlooked. So it's obvious that Gantz and the Blue and White Party are trying to make a shift to cultivate these soft right-wing voters, right? And that's why you've seen a lot of rhetoric from his end and other people in Blue and White in terms of supporting annexing or sovereignty in certain parts of the West Bank, the Jordan Valley, and so on and so forth. What people are sometimes forgetting is that Blue and White were built on a million-plus Israeli center-left and left-wing votes. And the question is, if Gantz had fully come out in support of this Trump administration plan and annexation and everything it connotes with regard to the settlements, what that would have done to his voter base and, by consequence, voter turnout in another 5 weeks. And so while I understand his, as Richard said, he did a very good job of calibrating and dancing through the raindrops, at least for now. We'll see how he does in Washington. But there is, I think, real-world, again, implications politically in Israel for whatever he supports and doesn't support.
Mm. Let's look at what the Palestinians are going to do. And we talked earlier about the situation that they've been in, and that ever since the Trump administration started to make changes to a lot of the framework of how U.S.-Palestinian relations work, that they have boycotted the U.S., essentially. They've not had any high-level talks. There was the one meeting in Washington that Abbas had with President Trump, but it pretty much soured since then. And so if this plan comes out, what are they going to do? So, the US administration and some of the advisors could be saying to Donald Trump, don't worry about the Palestinians. We cut the funding to UNRWA. Nothing really happened. We moved the embassy to Jerusalem. Yes, there was, very bad violence on the Gaza border led by Hamas, but nothing really happened in the West Bank. We can just keep moving in the direction we want to keep moving in, and I wouldn't worry about it. What do we think is going to be the next step of Abbas?
So I'll say, big picture, I don't think there'll be a severe and major reaction just by dint of the Americans releasing the plan. Mm. I think the real repercussions from the Palestinians will come in if and when an Israeli government actually takes unilateral steps on the West Bank. Mm. So I think we should put it kind of into a particular context. The Americans can release a piece of paper. It doesn't mean that the Middle East is going to explode. Now, delving into the details, I think it's true. If you talk to the Trump administration officials, they'll say, well, we did this and nothing happened, and we did that and nothing happened, and on down the line. I would argue, and I've written this in the past, that they've, at each of these junctures, whether politically or financially in most cases, but in every one of these decision points and junctures, the Americans have been bailed out by other actors. Mm. The other actors could have been the Europeans financially, including the UK, backstopping UNRWA funding. It could have been the Israelis on the ground with the IDF maintaining stability. Could have been the Palestinians themselves through the Palestinian Authority security forces, maintaining coordination, stopping demonstrations from kind of coalescing and getting out of control. The Arabs have also stepped into the breach, apparently financially, to help both the PA and the Gaza Strip. So in every one of these junctures, the Americans can say, well, nothing happened, but there are other governments and actors in the world who have kind of stepped into the breach. And
so you're saying that might not happen now?
The steps taken by an Israeli government, especially, let's say, annexation, there might not be enough money and political will and security capabilities to stop whatever may transpire.
Mm. I would just add that, I mean, I suppose the real concern on the ground is against conventional wisdom that there is no appetite to start up any form of armed intifada and violence. But such moves as annexation, as kind of changing even declaratory statements, changing the status on the Temple Mount or anything like that, could galvanize enough anger that would lead to real violence on the ground. I don't think just because it hasn't happened or been limited in the past doesn't mean that it wouldn't happen this time. So we have to be very careful whether there is any spark that could lead to an upsurge in violence. On a political level within Palestinian society, it will be a boost for Hamas and kind of the conventional Hamas thinking that says, you know what, you know, you can never trust the Israelis, you certainly can't trust the Americans either. 30 years of negotiations have got us nowhere. The real response has to be violence and terrorism, and so we could see a result in that. From the PA, we could see the return of, or the kind of a ratcheting up of what they refer to as lawfare. There is the case of the ICC being challenged right now. We could see more cases, kind of further impetus pushing Israel in international forums and suing them there, and using kind of the built-in minority in the UN institutions, etc., to embarrass and further try to isolate Israel. So there is, I think, a concern that there could be a backlash from the Palestinians that we don't know where we don't know where it starts. And we certainly don't know where it ends.
So if we're saying, in a sense, it doesn't matter what the US says, the key is actually going to be what Israel does. And if that is the case, then that brings me back to my earlier question, which is it likely that over the next few weeks, if there is some kind of plan or outline release, that moves are made by Benjamin Netanyahu, who has never done this in 10 years in office, has promised to apply Israeli sovereignty to the Jordan Valley, to all Israeli settlements. He's promised it in the last two elections. He's done nothing to do that. Do we really think that now he will actually tangibly do that? And then my second question is, can he actually do that? Because it would have to be presumably passed by the Knesset, where he doesn't have a majority, but he might have a kind of right-wing majority to do that. But would then, in my third question, would Israeli politicians then want that to happen, knowing that just ahead of an election, this could cause the very kind of a violence that you talked about? Presumably there are meetings going on right now where, or even over the weekend, where senior Israeli security officials and the IDF were probably saying just that and talking about the potential scenarios. Because we know that when Netanyahu talked about applying Israeli sovereignty to the Jordan Valley and settlements in the past, there were leaks to the Israeli media that the heads of the security agencies were extremely concerned about the manner in which it was done, and they were extremely concerned about the impact in Jordan and the West Bank. So, I mean, you know, I've asked a lot of questions there, but essentially, is it really going to happen? Is Israel really going to make this move just a few weeks out of an election with all the risks that we've discussed?
My short answer would be no. Yeah. I think that this is large. If we kind of go back to the first question, for me, this feels like all about a political game and about a rhetorical game. I don't think that the Knesset, from having an interim government, has any form of real desire to change any status quo and fundamental action on the ground. I do think that it will change the conversation and it will be part of the election campaign. And depending on the results of the next election after March the 2nd, then we could see some new policy initiatives. Certainly if the right-wing government is able to be formed, their majority, then they certainly will have a whip hand to develop. But in the next 5 weeks before the elections, I'd be very cynical that we see any substantial development.
I mean, I saw some polling recently that the Israeli public was not even that excited about applying Israeli sovereignty to the Jordan Valley. There wasn't even a 50% majority for it.
This is dominating, definitely over the past week or two, the headlines and the conversation. I think if you actually spoke to the average Israeli, I think the Jordan Valley ranks 8th, 9th, or 20th in their level of concern and their order of priorities. I think traffic jams and the state of the hospitals and taxes and the elections and the politics themselves rank a lot higher than the status of the Jordan Valley or any settlement in the West Bank. So I think this is pure kind of wedge issue politics played out on a global scale, so to speak.
There are lots of Israelis who are quoting the famous Henry Kissinger quote from decades ago, that it proves once again that in Israel there's no such thing as foreign policy, only domestic policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me. No doubt we will be talking about this again and again, and there'll be more interviews this week about these and other issues. But in the meantime, thank you for joining us.